Make no mistake, if you're an author, you're an entrepreneur. You're selling the world on your book, aren't you? Of course, it's not as easy as launching a business and then tossing any old book up on Amazon. That's why I help entrepreneurs publish books on the specific topic and in the specific way that will launch or grow their businesses. Welcome to Entrepreneur Publishing Academy with your professor, Anna David. Hi there. Welcome to Entrepreneur Publishing Academy. How are you today? You know what we talk about? We talk about books and how to write one and publish one that will build your business or, you know, make you into the superstar that you know you are. And today's episode is with my friend. She's one of those pandemic friends. So like I would say my good friend, but we haven't actually met. It just seems like we have. And I reached out to her. It was Clubhouse. Remember Clubhouse? I saw her on Clubhouse and I go, she does something kind of like what I do. And I reached out and said, hey, let's try to take over the world together. And she's so cool and so funny. And I couldn't believe she hadn't been on the podcast already. Enough with the suspense. Her name is Elizabeth Lyons. I call her Liz. That's because we're friends. But professionally, she is known as Elizabeth Lyons. She is somebody who helps people publish, write and publish their books. She's the creator of the Book Writing Accelerator. She's written 5 books herself. And she's really my comrade in arms. And in this episode, we get diverted a lot before we get to the main topic, which is what exactly should go in your nonfiction book. What should your table of contents look like? How do you start? All of those things is so good. To get the show notes, which you want, go to legacylaunchpadpub.com/blog/Liz. And now I give you Elizabeth Lyons. This is so long overdue.
Right?
Would you not agree?
I would totally agree. It's so funny because right when you messaged me, I had been thinking the exact same thing. Well, that I need to get you on mine.
You came and spoke to my class, and I get that confused sometimes with, This person has already been a guest. But so we quote unquote met early pandemic, I would say, where I noted your existence. And I did what I will sometimes do. And I said, I need to know this person. And I reached out and I said, should we know each other? And you basically said, yes. Is that how you remember it?
I mean, who remembers anything before 2 days ago? Like, I barely remember, like, did I eat breakfast today? I don't even know. But yes, that rings true.
It doesn't ring false.
It does not ring false. Exactly.
And I thought, my God, we do such similar things that we need to take over the world together or do whatever. And it's been glorious on several levels. A, we refer each other clients because we kind of offer different-ish yet similar things.
Right.
And B, just to have someone to go to text and go, whoa, do you deal with this?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, 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 I do.
And you know what I love about it too, is that we do the similar things.
Yeah.
And as you said, we do them slightly differently. And sometimes it's really reassuring, I think, in any space to recognize that there's a devil at every level, so to speak.
Tell me more.
Well, just meaning that it doesn't matter if you're offering a free course, a $47 course, a $1,000 course, a $25,000 package, a $100,000 package. When it comes to just managing expectations, setting expectations, getting really clear about what a client is looking to do and whether or not you're the right person to help with that, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have packages at levels that I don't have packages at. And we talk about some of the same things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes I feel like I've sort of given you this talk. It's like the people who pay the least are the most demanding and the people who pay the most are the least demanding. And I don't know if it's part of some, 80-20 principle or
Or just it, having clients is the most fascinating experience in expectations. What it's taught me is when I haven't been a good client.
Doesn't exactly
it do that to you? Because it's yes. like, I just had a surgery and I try to think of it the way that my clients think of our service. They come in, they don't know anything about it. What I know, I forget they don't know.
Absolutely.
And so it's constantly knowing that what you're dealing with is people's fear around the fact that they don't understand.
Exactly.
And they shouldn't, because...
And that's what I say all the time, because you and I both deal with incredibly, you know, successful, confident, and I don't just mean success in terms of their bank account. I mean, they know of what they speak. They are confident in who they are. They walk with a certain, the whole thing. Yeah. And yet... sometimes they feel like there's something wrong with them because they can't figure out this book writing and publishing thing. And that's what I say all the time. Is, well, why would you know this?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. why would you know what the surgeon is going to do with your intestines?
Right.
It's not something that you have an interest necessarily in spending time researching.
Right. That's why you've hired us.
Correct.
So let's talk about your journey, totally different than mine.
Right.
Let's also talk about how you have 5 children and I don't even understand, but go on. Okay. So it starts with you looking at, I want to publish a book. Let me look into this traditional thing. What happened?
I mean, kind of, right? So it started with, finding out I was having twins, always having wanted to write something, not being sure, like, what was I actually capable or qualified to write? Because I didn't have a degree in writing and all the things that people back then, this was 2002, said you had to have. So I find out I'm expecting twins and I want a book that basically doesn't exist. And so I think, maybe I can write that. And the first thing I thought to do was go traditional, because back then that was the only, that was the only thing to do, really. So I tried and I queried and I queried and I queried some more. And everybody was like, nope, your market's not big enough. That's all I heard. And this was before Amazon, social media. It was just all based on market. Like, how big is your readership? And the feeling was that because my readership wasn't in the potentially millions, that I didn't have a viable product. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, that I don't like the word no. I've never liked the word no. So I thought, well, how hard can it be, right? Famous last words. So I did go initially with, I guess, what you would call a vanity publisher, you know, and it didn't go great because, as we were just saying, I didn't know what questions to ask. So when I was told things like, we're going to do this for you and we're going to do that for you, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Right. Not really realizing what that meant and didn't mean. And so it became clear very quickly that I was on the losing end of this deal in this particular case, because I was fronting all the money, which is a fine business model, in my opinion, for book publishing or really anything else. But they were keeping still like 70% of the profit. I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah.
So it just didn't make any sense. So I quickly cut ties with them and then started all over on my own. And that's where I figured out step by step by step by Google search, you know, how to do it. And then it did well.
Well, so it's interesting. I was just reading Jane Friedman's Hot Sheet, and there's yes. been this huge exploration of what they call hybrid publishing, which hybrid publishing means 2 things. It's what we do, where people pay us in order to do the work for them. And it's also when you pay somebody and they take a percentage. And nobody in this report has any judgment about what we're doing, but there's great judgment about that model.
I'm not going to lie. I have great judgment about that model.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why I don't run my publishing house that way.
Right. It seems like a terrible idea, even from a business standpoint for them, since most books sell 300 copies.
Exactly.
So they're setting themselves up for people to be upset.
Not only that, the accounting end of it, the administrative end of it for the publishing house, I have to imagine is insane.
Yeah.
Because I know what it is just for my books.
Yeah.
Just checking my own personal books, the books I've written and published, and what
they're earning on all the different platforms each month. And some pay 90 days and some pay it 30 days. And then there can be returns if you're with, you know, Ingram Spark and you therefore are distributing to bookstores or whatever. Right. And so all of those things come into play. And to figure out what you owe an author, number one. And number two, for the author to look at that report and have confidence that it's correct. And I'm not suggesting that it's not correct. I'm just saying that I know, having worked with a wonderful distributor way, 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 way back in the day before Amazon to get my books in bookstores, I would get their report at the end of the month and we could not figure out, is this even right?
Right. I'm very challenged with reports and numbers anyway, so I don't even try. I've never looked at my book sales, ever, ever, ever. I just take a check if it comes.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you get everything back from this company and you figure out all the things, which back then must have been extremely challenging.
Extremely. Yes. I mean, that's an understatement because it was really, I don't even know if I was just a masochist or extremely determined, which was it,
right? Hard to tell on a lot of
it really was. Yeah. Because when I think back now, there's so many resources, there are almost too many resources, which is an opposite end of the spectrum problem for people because you can Google deep dive all day long and never really know which approach you quote unquote should choose. 100%. So, but that's what I did is I just kept diving and figuring it out. What's an ISBN? Do I need an ISBN? These people are saying, I don't need an ISBN. Does that feel valid, you know, in reading and really just finding out, to be honest, who my mentors in the space were, like who was I listening to? And then if I trusted them and I did, I took their advice and I went from there. And if it worked, it worked. And if it didn't, I pivoted again.
Then was Jane Friedman the only voice, or she wasn't even there doing it yet?
Back then, I didn't know of Jane Friedman. And it's funny, I was so excited to see the hot sheet in my inbox this morning. So I learned about Jane Friedman probably 6 years ago, because I think Jane, and I don't want to speak for her, but I feel like she's pivoted a little bit. She was very much more in the traditional space with proposals and things like that. And that's not the space I've ever been in, because ever since going indie in 2005, I suppose, that's, you know, I do follow some agents now because I'm still interested in what's going on in the traditional space. I follow Jane. Jane is an absolute unbelievable wealth of information.
She's her podcast guest. I just secured her.
Oh, good for you. She's remarkable.
Remarkable.
And one of the things I really like about Jane's slight side note is that this is going to become the Jane fan show is that she sits fairly squarely in the middle. Like she doesn't tell people you should do this or you should do that. She just presents information as it becomes available to her. And I really respect that.
It's funny because when I first stumbled across her, you know, my big heartbreak in publishing was when Judith Regan was fired. You know, she acquires my book for a lot of money. It's all exciting. And then she's fired by a woman named Jane Friedman, who was right under Rupert Murdoch at Fox. And who's now does audiobooks and like, she was the focus of my ire. Cause it's like, I'm not going to focus on Murdoch. I've always loved Judith Regan. So it was like, and then I discovered that there's Jane Friedman's, you know, an expert on publishing. I mean, literally for 5 years, that's who I thought it was.
Yeah.
Different one.
That's funny. That's a great story.
I told Jane that, I wrote a piece that she published on her site. And when I pitched her, I was like, by the way, I thought this was you for a long time. So who were you following back then?
That's a great,
there were those dudes. There's that guy JT something. Like there was a guy that really made a lot of headway. He made a lot of money as an indie author. And he was one of the first, I can't remember his name, people I discovered.
You know,
his name was Barry something. Go on.
Ooh, that rings a bell though. Yeah. Barry's, that name rings a bell. I was so admittedly, I had blinders on. So I don't even remember, because to call them my mentors actually is probably a little bit of a misstatement, because it's not like I was following, you know, nobody had newsletters back then. We didn't have social media. I wasn't following anybody. It's just per se, when you did a Google search on how do I know if I need an ISBN, for example, there were certain websites and resources that would always come up at the top of the Google search. And so I became uber familiar with those. Mm-hmm. And one of the first people that I started following very seriously, although this was probably after I had done at least two books and maybe three of my own, was Dave Chesson.
Of course, yes.
You know, because he too is just an absolute wealth of not just information, but tactical, like, here's how you do this.
Yeah. I love him. He, you know, he writes his books under another name.
Does he really?
Because he told me he was the first guest I had when we switched this podcast to being about books. Because he's like, well, I don't want to exploit the fact that I have a name in publishing. Ah, wow. Bow down to him. By the way, it was Barry Eisler. I just Googled.
Yep. That name is very familiar.
Yeah. And it's saying he turned down $500,000 publishing contract for two books and then went and did self-publishing, and it's, you know, been terribly successful. So you figure it out and you publish your book. And what happens? Your first book.
So I published my book, and in my opinion, really nothing happened, to be honest, because we didn't have Amazon. We didn't have anything. I didn't have an agent or a publisher telling me, oh, these are your required sales. Like I was just getting a check every month, and it wasn't earth shattering. It wasn't tens of thousands of dollars, but it was, I mean, I was at that time a mom of, I don't know, a 4-year-old, 2-year-old twins. And I think I was pregnant with the next one. Like it was happy for anything, but it was more than anything.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was like, okay, that's interesting, because go ahead.
It was between something and anything.
It was between something and anything. I mean, it was 4 figures.
Yeah.
It was low 4 figures every month, right? Yeah. And it was like, wait a minute. Like, I'm not promoting this. I don't understand. And so I didn't really have a handle at all on what the sales numbers were until several, probably years later. I had hired a publicist who was helping me get on radio and local TV, and mostly radio. We didn't have podcasts yet. And she mentioned a girl to me by the name of Jenna McCarthy, mm-hmm. who is in, well, now she's in Texas, but at the time she was in California. And somehow she connected the two of us, because Jenna had just written a book called The Parent Trip that was released by one of the big 5 traditional publishers. And she said, you know, you guys are so similar, you should connect. So Jenna and I connected. And then Jenna was mentioning my book to her agent at the time, and her agent went into BookScan out of curiosity and said, oh my God, she has sold more books than most of my clients who are traditionally published. And at the time, the number was like 25,000 copies or something like that. And I was like, really?
25,000 is so many.
Like, okay. And what's interesting about that though, Anna, is that if that had been one and done, if I had only done that book, I would be sitting here telling you a very different story, because I'd be sitting here going, it's easy.
Right. I know.
You write a book with a niche market and you just put it out there and it just goes.
Don't you think the universe just doles these out usually in the beginning of our careers? Oh, it's like, I wonder if I never thought about this, just a gateway drug. The universe is like, we're going to give you this, and you don't realize this is your blessing. You're like, you know what?
Uh-huh.
I've always kind of deserved this. So here we go with my career, right?
Right. I'm raising all these children. Come on. I deserve something. Yeah. That's an interesting perspective, because, you know, when I did book two, it was the sequel to book one. Book one was newborn twins, first year with twins. Book two was toddler years with twins. And so that was a natural, I mean, it didn't sell as well as the first, but it sold well. Mm-hmm. Then I did book three, total flop. Now, in my opinion, here's why. Same market, same demographic, But the demographic wasn't just moms of twins or multiples. It was all moms. So now I was competing with Stephanie. I can't remember her last name right now.
Yeah, Baby on Board. Stephanie, she's a friend of mine. Taylor, Stephanie Taylor or something. Yes. Whittle.
Sippy Cups Are Not for Chardonnay. Yeah. It was the book that came out at right around the same. Plus Jenny McCarthy had her. Yep. Was that Baby on Board? Like she had her books. Everybody, all the celebrities and the people had their books coming out and they were on the Today Show. And what was mine? Who am I? I had no press. I had no nothing. So, and I had no email list.
And that's an interesting, you know, we always talk about the riches are in the niches. I always thought of it like, you know, what I really learned from Ryan Holiday, which is you drill down on a niche and then that those people feel that there's a book that's written precisely for them. So they start recommending it. But I actually hadn't thought of it that your competition grows to the most popular authors that exist if you're not niching down.
Well, and to be fair, because I'm kind of comparing apples and oranges, if I had known how to communicate with the 30,000 people, you know, who had purchased the first and or the second book, I could have sold a lot more books. I mean, Ryan Holiday, who I think is magnificent, has always been more. Back then, and sometimes even now, but back then, I didn't have a business mind about being an author. I wanted it to sell and I liked the check that came in and I felt creative. But again, I was raising four very young children. So I wasn't thinking about, would I have loved to get on the Today Show or do something with it? And did I try to do? Absolutely. But I wasn't as knee deep in it as I am now. And even now, to be honest, my knee deepness is not about promoting my own books. It's about helping other people write theirs.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know about you, but I basically write books in order to stay on top of the latest and try techniques out that I can try on clients. Do you think
that's that's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, when I wrote my last book, the fifth one, it was really something I wanted to say because it was something that I was experiencing as an entrepreneur. And so it was a bunch of stuff that had been on my mind for a while that I had figured out how to think about differently and have a different perspective on. And I wanted to say, but I do think a lot now that I'm book coaching, I think a lot now about how did I write all those books? You know, what was my process for doing that? I incorporate that.
What I think that you said too, that's really interesting is that, you know, it has to be something you're interested in exploring. When I was on the traditional publishing, like you got to do a book a year path, I was writing about stuff I didn't really care about, which is crazy to me. And it's like, I released this podcast episode today with Paul Angoni, and he was just talking about, you have to be so passionate about this that you're willing to talk about it for years and focus for years. And I have written books where I don't feel like that at all.
And here's the thing is that I've not been traditionally published, but from what I understand, because I know a lot of people who have, it's more of a business over there. You know, it's like what cover will sell, what content will sell, what voice will sell, what topic will sell, what controversy will sell. And so that's why sometimes people, not all authors, but some authors get quote unquote roped in to writing a book that they're not super passionate about, or they write a book that they were passionate about. But then once the editor gets a hold of it and makes it into what they think is marketable, all of a sudden the author's like, this isn't even my book anymore. It doesn't feel like my book anymore. And therefore it's hard to talk about it and promote it. But that's something I stand very, very firmly on. And this is something you and I have talked about. And I believe I'm going to let you correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but I'm pretty sure we share this opinion. If you're going to write about, please let it be something that you're super passionate about talking about for as long as you're passionate about talking about it. If you decide in 6 months or 3 years or 10 years that you don't want to talk about it anymore, totally fine. That's when your sales are going to drop off because somebody else is talking about it.
And it's ironic. Well, I mean, what you said is this thing about traditional publishing is more like a business, and I'd never really thought about it like that, but it's the business is for the traditional publisher because they don't think about it at all as a business for the author, which is why they're capturing the email address. I mean, they're not really capturing email addresses of Amazon anyway, But the idea is, you know, when a book is finished, they don't want, you know, the number one thing that people want to do when they finish a book, if they finish it, is connect with the author, connect with the publisher. Why would
And that's what I say all the time. People don't buy books from publishers. So people will come to me and they'll say, well, Elizabeth, I really want a traditional publisher. And the main reasons why people want a traditional publisher, in my experience, are they think there's a huge advance.
Yeah.
They think that there's huge marketing.
Yeah.
You know, and connecting. And it's like, and also they don't understand the timeline. They don't understand that it's going to be 3 years, if not more, depending on how long it takes to get the agent and et cetera. But I say, when they say about the marketing, I'm like, this is such a huge misconception because people don't buy books from publishers. They buy books from authors, especially in the day of social media,
yeah,
when you can actually connect with those authors. Nobody's out there connecting with Penguin on social media.
I know. And it's interesting. Jennifer Armstrong, who I had on the podcast, who has a New York Times bestseller, she's like, you got to just think of them as a printing service. You're just going to be disappointed if you think of them as more than that. So how did you start getting in touch with your readers and getting your newsletter subscribers and all of that?
Really, that started when social media started. Mm-hmm. And when there just became a way, I mean, I went through all the like rigmarole that we all hear about, you know, have a lead magnet and have the word funnel make, I have a visceral reaction and it's not good because it makes me think of like funneling cattle into a pen. But I understand what people are, you know, saying when they say it. And the idea is go out and find them, which is easier now than it's ever been, and then offer them a reason to stay connected to you, which is not, in my experience, like it depends on your genre, to be clear.
Yeah.
So I don't work with fiction writers, and their opportunities for connecting with readers are very different from nonfiction or memoir because it's more character-based and it's more story-based. Whereas, especially with nonfiction, it's more self-development based.
And it does seem a massive generalization. It's far easier for certain genres of fiction writers to churn it out and to really have their business model be backlist and, you know, giving perma-free one book so that they get the series and all of that. And I do think it's much harder to churn it out if you're doing nonfiction.
It's a completely different approach. Like you can almost look at it. I think of it, most people don't realize that on Amazon, the paperback store and the Kindle store are two different stores. Mm-hmm. Even though they merged together, they are two different databases on Amazon. I think of this in the same way. When you're a fiction writer versus a nonfiction or a memoir writer, it's two completely different. You're all writing books, but the approach to marketing and the, like you said, the perma-free on the first one and then building up a backlist and getting people involved in the next character and doing pre-orders and all those sorts of things, which is what people do very successfully in the fiction realm, is wildly different from the nonfiction and the memoir realm. And especially in the nonfiction realm, so many of at least my clients are looking to build their business, which revolves around, it's either based on their book or their book is an extension of something where they're already coaching, teaching, guiding, whatever verb, you know, you want to use, other people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's same with our clients. So, but wait, okay. I do want to go back to one thing. What do you think it was with your first book? Just straight up beginner's luck?
You know what? The truth is, I don't know for sure. What I suspect, I don't think it was beginner's luck. I think that I hit without realizing it. I like it's that whole preparation meets opportunity thing. And it's like I hit the opportunity because there were only a few books on the market about expecting twins to begin with. And they were all at the time quite like your life is over. They weren't, you know, and this was when Vicky Iovine was really big with her Girlfriend's Guide stuff. And honestly, Anna, that's what I wanted. I was like, Vicky, why couldn't you have had twins and written the Girlfriend's Guide to Twins? Because that's the book I need right now. Mm-hmm. But she didn't. And so I saw that as an opportunity. And I think that there were happened to be a lot of people who wanted that. And the other thing was, it wasn't just book orders. It was, there were, unbeknownst to me for a while, there were hospitals ordering in bulk because they were running what was called Marvelous Multiples, which was a program that had been put together by a nurse who was also a mom of twins that was being offered by different hospitals. And the hospitals were ordering volume and giving the book to all of the participants in those classes.
Oh, well, don't you think that was your big thing? I mean, do you know how many sales just that alone?
I don't, because the only way to get that information is through BookScan, and even BookScan is unreliable when it comes to off-market stuff. Like, it was all through the distributor I was working with.
Wow.
And I just, if you had seen, I mean, my reports for my distributor every month were 15 pages long.
Overwhelmed.
So I couldn't.
So have you tried to reverse engineer that and be like, I'm going to write a book that I know institutions can bulk order?
I haven't, because, and it's an interesting question. And I guess the answer is, because right now the answer is because that feels formulaic to me. And I don't write in a formulaic, you know, I'm not. So there are certain modalities that say, here's how you can figure out what kind of a book will sell. You can go out on Amazon and you can see what people are searching for. And if you know a lot of people are searching for this certain thing, then you know that if you write a book about it, it will probably maybe sell well.
Right.
But that is just an approach that has never felt good to me. I write like it, stuff just comes through me, and I that's how I write. So
interesting. I know. I've read those things. I've read those, and it'll literally be like, lots of people are searching for kids playing tennis. I've never played tennis, but I'm going to write a book about that. And right. I think that was really effective for a while. I will say I use it and I teach it, which is, you know, your book. And I mean, I got this from Dave Chesson. So start looking in Amazon to see how it auto-populates, because mm-hmm. you're already writing the book. So include sections that people are already searching for. I do find that really helpful.
I find that really helpful too. And another thing that I find very helpful is recognizing what the keywords are that people are searching for and making sure that those are in not only your book description, but if possible, your reviews.
Which, yes.
That's
and
a whole
by
different...
the way, your author bio.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. Yeah. So by the way, remember it was yesterday. We're going back and forth about, we got to find an exact angle for this episode. And of course, because we have so much to talk about, we really haven't gotten into the angle. Well, we're kind of verging on it now, which is, what do you put in your book? That was the angle we decided. Like, how do you find out, you know, how do you basically come up with, I don't know, your table of contents? Is that kind of what we're doing? What are we doing?
So, yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I find and I hear all the time holds people back from actually writing their book, because, you know, my clients are doing the writing themselves. So they are like, I have a story. I have something to share. I either have a story like my life, or I have a process if we're talking about business. And sometimes there's a little bit of crossover. But where they get stuck most of the time is, it's like, I'm so overwhelmed. So they do what's normally suggested or often suggested, which is they do this big brain dump. And one of two things happens. Either it's 75 pages long and they can't figure out how to make it all come together with a nice bow, or it's like four things because they're overthinking it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to think through, like, well, should I talk about that? Well, should I talk about that? Well, I don't know. Have I been working on that long enough to actually position myself as an expert, air quotes, on it? And so that's where they get stuck, is in figuring out, what do we include and what do we not include? And when you're ghostwriting, which you're intimately familiar with, obviously, you guide them through that process of figuring out, well, what is the table of contents? And I'm working on a ghostwriting project right now. And that's something that had to happen. Was, you know, what are those? But that's where people get really stuck and they don't progress from there because they come up with some story, pun intended, about, well, clearly I shouldn't be doing this because I can't figure out.
So how do you guide them? What's the process?
Well, it's different for fiction or for nonfiction versus memoir. So nonfiction in my world is much more tactical. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do you want to say? What are the, what, first of all, what is the thing that your book is guiding people through? Because it's not a whole mess of things. It's not everything you've ever done. It's like, what do you want this book to help a reader overcome? Mm-hmm. And then what are the steps that you take people through? And more often than not, with that sort of a book, if the author is operating in integrity, they have gone through that. That's the process they created for themselves.
Yep.
So it's like, take yourself back 3 years, 5 years, whatever it was, and identify what were the things, what were the steps that really worked for you? What were the things that you needed to hear and know back then?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's kind of where we start to get clear on that.
I love it. It's so, it was always interesting to me when people differentiate between nonfiction and memoir. I was like, memoir is nonfiction.
It is.
But, you know, it's interesting. Rob Fitzpatrick, who I recently had on the show, was talking about a how-to book, how-to versus memoir, because really that's what we're talking about. And so is there anything else about, like, okay, take it back 6 months, 5 years, however long it is that you developed this process and you're now explaining to other people, what do you do next? You go, okay, so for instance, I'm doing a book right now about how to plan and promote a book. So, right. and this is different because I'm taking podcast interviews and I'm doing it, but like, how would we do that? We would go, how would you guide someone through that? You go, okay, so what was your starting point? Is that how it starts?
Exactly. Like, what, you know, one of the things that I find very effective is for authors to write a letter to their reader first.
I love it.
And more often than not, the reader is them, who they were 3 or 5 years ago. So essentially what you're doing is you're connecting with your reader. You're getting outside of yourself. And outside of your, I have to be, you're getting outside of your perfectionist tendencies in order to say, dear whomever, name them if you want. Here's what I know to be true about you. Here's where I know you are right now. Here's what your fears are. Here's what's keeping you from moving forward. Here's what you're really, really good at, but here's where you're stuck. And I have great news. Like, again, now we're going into like the typical copy editing stuff, but
right,
or marketing stuff. But the good news is there's a path. And one of the things that's really important is that authors not hold themselves as the savior to the reader. So all you're saying is, here is a path. You are not saying here is the one and only path. That takes the pressure off everyone. But here's the thing. I want to share with you my process that I used to get through this and or that I utilize when I'm helping my clients or however you whatever, get through this.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what we're going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to get really clear and you don't have to get into the nitty gritty of it at that point. But when, what you're doing when you do that is you're creating the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just comes down to what goes into the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're creating the hub of the wheel and what's in that, what's encapsulated in that hub.
Do you have a certain set number of chapters that you recommend?
I don't. I mean, I think most nonfiction end up between like 12 and 18 chapters. And it just depends on, you know, I don't subscribe to a word count. I think anything under 40,000 words or under 35,000 words is a pamphlet, not a book.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a stickler about that. Maybe 35,000, but I don't believe in adding words just to add words. I think that when you're really connected to helping, and that's what a book really is about, is serving.
Yep.
So when people come to me, and this doesn't happen much anymore, but, and they say, look, I just want to hit a bestseller list for 5 minutes so that I can say I'm a best-selling author. And that's going to sell me tons of books and make me millions of dollars and make me the sought after expert on every stage. That's not the right person for me.
Right.
You know,
so, I do.
Yeah, I know you know this, and I know we share this.
Intimately.
Yeah. So when you're really looking to serve another person through telling your stories, it's not hard to get 40,000 words, 50,000 words, or even 60,000 words. It's just not.
But do you find, I know on a personal level, I like reading shorter books now.
A lot of people do.
I hate to say it, but I do. And studies are showing that, because it just means you can read more. And some authors are just going on and on and on. I find self-help has never been my thing. And it's like, I always feel like the first chapter says it and then the next 10 are repeating it. But that could be me.
You know, I think that often is the case. That often is the case. And if you don't have enough to get yourself to, you know, something solid, I mean, 80,000 words is such an old paradigm, because it's what was the average back in the day for traditional books, mostly fiction based.
Yeah.
Or mostly, you know, fiction. But I think there's always an exception. So there are a lot of people who say, well, I don't like to read long books. And you have to kind of dive into why that is.
Yeah.
Because when those people find a book that's 250 pages long, that is just chock full of amazing information and stories, they read it.
Yeah.
So it may not be that they don't like reading long books. It may be that they don't like reading repetitive nonsense, number one.
Right.
And number two, if there's someone who wants to be like, well, I read a book a week, but in order to accomplish that goal, they know the book has to only be 97 pages. Well, then there's their motivation.
Right. Well, okay, so we have to get to wrapping up. Do you have any final advice for somebody who's, I mean, I guess who wants to write a how-to book, what they should do?
Well, I mean,
hire you.
What's that?
Hire you.
Or you. I mean, whether you want to write how-to or memoir, and to be clear, the distinction between the two for me is that when you're writing what I call transformative nonfiction or how-to, we can call it whatever, but you want the reader to take an action. There is a very specific action that you are giving to the reader with the hope that they may take it. When you're writing memoir, you are not attached to what they take from the story.
Yeah.
That to me is the difference. But I think it's really important, and I've always said this, to just understand why you really want to do it. And then what's the why under that why, and what's the why, you know, do the six layers or whatever deep of why. Because once you, as with anything, once you really uncover why you want to do it and what you want to get out of it, you can execute it most efficiently. Mm-hmm. Whether that's write it yourself, hire someone to write it for you, write a 30-page ebook, do a novel, like whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. I love it. So if people want to reach you, what's the best way? And let's just also quickly say all your offers, because you have courses, you have coaching, go.
So funny, I've minimized, I've simplified. So
you have courses still.
I have one.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I think I've told you, I'm so frustrated by trying to sell courses. It's just, you know, in the beginning of the conversation, you were like, is this masochism or is this determination? That's right. How I feel about trying to sell you guys, my courses are so good and you don't buy them.
Yeah. Listen. And I feel exactly the same. And I know your courses and you know, my course, like I get it. I think for me, so I have the Book Writing Accelerator, which is my 12-week intimate group program. And it's a coaching program through writing nonfiction or memoir. Writing nonfiction and memoir is an experience, period. It's not something that in my world, we sit down and do in a weekend. It is a full-on experience, and you're learning about yourself as you're writing the book, period. And then I have my course, the only course I have now, which is how to publish a book. How to self-publish a book that can be sit next to any New York Times bestseller and be indistinguishable in quality.
Yep. Yeah.
So those are my two things.
Well, so people can take those courses. They can sign up for your coaching. Is your coaching, you know, do you just launch a few times a year?
I do. But the next one launches in July. We start in July and it goes for 12 weeks. And I usually do 2 or 3 containers a year of that. Mm-hmm. And then the publishing course is evergreen.
And then of course they can get your books.
Of course.
Of course. Well, and so where can they find you online?
The best place is elizabethlyons.com. And that'll take people out to the course sites and the coaching site, wherever they want to go. But the hub is elizabethlyons.com.
Well, this has been such a delight. I'm so glad we finally did this.
Me too.
And you guys, thank you as ever for listening. Go find her.
Thanks for joining me this week on Entrepreneur Publishing Academy with Anna David. For more info about the show, go to entrepreneurpublishing.academy, where you can get links to show notes and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, and all the other places. Speaking of those places, if you got anything out of this show, I can't tell you how much I'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. And please, don't forget you can tell an author or entrepreneur friend about the show. Another forget-me-not, my company Legacy Launchpad Publishing is available to help industry leaders and those with stories to share at any stage in their publishing journeys, whether that's writing, editing, or publishing. Just go to legacylaunchpadpub.com to find out more. And be sure to tune in next week for next week's episode. You know, if you subscribe, you never have to worry about missing one.